So if you turn to the Gold Kadamba Center prayer book, to page 3, we'll start with praise to Shakyamuni Buddha in English. To the founder, the endowed, transcendent destroyer, the one gone beyond, the foe destroyer, the completely perfected, fully awakened being, perfect in knowledge and in good conduct, Sugata, knower of the world, supreme God of human beings to be tamed, teacher of gods and human beings, to you, the completely and fully awakened one, the endowed, transcendent destroyer, the glorious conqueror, the subduer from the Shakya clan, I prostrate, make offerings, and go for refuge. To the founder, the endowed, transcendent destroyer, the one gone beyond, the foe destroyer, the completely perfected, fully awakened being, perfect in knowledge and in good conduct. Sugata, knower of the world, supreme God of human beings to be tamed, teacher of gods and humans, to you, the completely and fully awakened one, the endowed transcendent destroyer, the glorious conqueror, the subduer from the Shakya clan, I prostrate, make offerings, and go for refuge. To the founder, the endowed transcendent destroyer, the one gone beyond, the foe destroyer, the completely perfected, fully awakened being, perfect in knowledge and in good conduct, Sugata, knower of the world, supreme God of human beings to be tamed, teacher of gods and human beings, to you, the completely and fully awakened one, the endowed transcendent destroyer, the glorious conqueror, subduer from the Shakya clan, I prostrate, make offerings, and go for refuge. When, O Supreme, amongst humans you were born on this earth, you paced out 7 strides, then said, I am supreme in this world. To you who were wise then, I prostrate. With pure bodies, form supremely pure, wisdom ocean like a golden mountain, fame that blazes in the 3 worlds, winner of the best, Lord, to you I prostrate. With the supreme signs, face like spotless moon, color like gold, to you I prostrate. Just 3 like you, the 3 worlds are not, incomparably wise one, to you I prostrate. The Savior having great compassion, the Founder having all understanding, the field of merit with qualities like a vast ocean, to you the one gone to thusness, I prostrate. The purity that frees one from attachment, the virtue that frees one from the lower realms, the one path, the sublime pure reality, to the Dharma that pacifies, I prostrate. Those who are liberated and who also show the path to liberation, the holy field qualified with realizations, who are devoted to the moral precepts, to you the sublime community intending virtue, I prostrate. Homage to the Supreme Buddha, homage to the Dharma refuge, homage to the great Sangha, to all 3 ever devout homage, to all worthy of respect, bowing with bodies as many as all realms, atoms in all aspects, with supreme faith I pay homage. Do not commit any virtuous actions. Perform only perfect virtuous actions. Subdue your mind thoroughly. This is the teaching of the Buddha. A star, a visual aberration, a flame of a lamp, an illusion, a drop of dew or a bubble, a dream, a flash of lightning, a cloud. See, conditioned things as this. Through these merits may sentient beings attain the rank of all seeing, subdue the foe of faults, and be delivered from samsara's ocean, perturbed by the waves of aging, sickness, and death. Then turn to page 8. I prostrate to the Arya Triple Gem. Thus did I hear at one time. The Bhagavan was dwelling on massive Vultures Mountain in Rajagriha, together with a great community of monks and a great community of bodhisattvas. At that time, the Bhagavan was absorbed in the concentration on the categories of phenomena called profound perception. Also at that time, the bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara looked upon the very practice of the profound perfection of wisdom and beheld the those 5 aggregates also as empty of inherent nature. Then through the power of Buddha, the Venerable Shariputra said this to the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara. How should any son of the lineage train who wishes to practice the activity of the profound perfection of wisdom? He said that, and the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara said this to the Venerable Shariputra. Shariputra, any son of the lineage or daughter of the lineage who wishes to practice the activity of the profound perfection of wisdom should look upon it like this, correctly and repeatedly beholding those 5 aggregates also as empty of inherent nature. Form is empty. Emptiness is form. Emptiness is not other than form. Form is also not other than emptiness. In the same way, feeling, discrimination, compositional factors, and consciences are empty. Shariputra, likewise, all phenomena are emptiness, without characteristic, unproduced, unceased, stainless, not without stain, not deficient, not fulfilled. Shariputra, therefore in emptiness there is no form, no feeling, no discrimination, no compositional factors, no consciousness, no eye, no ear, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, no visual form, no sound, no odor, no taste, no object of touch, and no phenomenon. There is no eye element, and so on up to and including no mind element, and no mental consciousness element. There is no ignorance, no extinction of ignorance, and so on up to and including no aging and death, and no extinction of aging and death. Similarly, there is no suffering, origination, cessation, and path. There is no exalted wisdom, no attainment, and also no non-attainment. Shariputra, therefore, because there is no attainment, bodhisattvas rely on and dwell in the perfection of wisdom, the mind without obscuration and without fear. Having completely passed beyond error, they reach the end point of nirvana. All the Buddhas who dwell in the three times also manifestly completely awaken to unsurpassable, perfect, complete enlightenment and reliance on the perfection of wisdom. Therefore, the mantra of the perfection of wisdom, the mantra of great knowledge, the unsurpassed mantra, the mantra equal to the unequaled, the mantra that thoroughly pacifies all suffering, should be known as truth since it is not false. The mantra of the perfection of wisdom is declared. Tayata om gate gate para gate para sam gate bodhisoha. Shariputra, the bodhisattva mahasattva should train in the profound perfection of wisdom like that. Then the Bhagavan arose from that concentration and commended the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara, saying, well said, son of the lineage, it is like that. One should practice the profound perfection of wisdom just as you have indicated. Even the Tathagatas rejoice. The Bhagavan, having thus spoken, the Venerable Shariputra, the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara, those surrounding in their entirety, along with the world of gods, humans, asuras, and gandhavas, were overjoyed and highly praised that spoken by the Bhagavan. Oh, can people hear now? Okay, so let's generate our motivation and appreciate the opportunity we have to listen to teachings and know that it's very difficult to have this opportunity because it's hard to have the external conditions as well as the internal conditions to listen to the Dharma. And so seeing as we have the chance now, let's pay attention, let's take the Dharma into our hearts, and let's let it affect us with compassion so that we can work for the benefit of all living beings. And repay their kindness through practicing the Dharma and learning the methods to really benefit others in the long term. And so with that kind of intention, let's listen to the teachings this evening. Yeah, that might be good. Thank you. Okay. So, everybody in North Carolina, thank you for coming. I realize this is late for a weeknight teaching. And the reason we're doing it is because at Shravasti Abbey, we stream live a teaching every Thursday night. So it's 6 o'clock where I live. So that's why the teaching's so late. And we're just at the beginning of going through the 400 stanzas by Aryadeva. And it's a very precious text. Aryadeva was one of Nagarjuna's disciples, perhaps his main disciple. And the abbey is fortunate to have Yeshe Tabke come and teach the first four chapters of this text at the abbey in July. And so as a way to prepare for it, then I'm going through those four chapters now so that people can, you know, become familiar and start to contemplate and so on. So I'm not going to review. Last week was the first week and I kind of gave the overall view of the text. So I'm sorry, I'm not going to give it again for you guys. But it's online on BlipTV under Shravasti Abbey, so you can watch it there. But basically, the first four chapters are counteracting what's known as the four distortions. And so these four will also come up tomorrow night when we talk about the Four Noble Truths. So they're seeing what is impermanent as permanent, seeing what is foul or unclean in nature as pure, seeing what is unsatisfactory in nature as happy and blissful, and seeing what lacks a self as having a self. So those four distortions are functioning in our minds 24/7, pretty much. And they really lie at the root of all these afflictions that manifest in our mind. And then, of course, from the afflictions, we create karma. From karma, we continue rebirth in cyclic existence. So the very first chapter, which is what we're starting with now, is counteracting the first distortion, which is seeing what is impermanent as permanent. And so this first chapter doesn't talk so much about subtle impermanence, which is the real thing that we want to get at, but it talks a lot about gross impermanence, which is death. Okay, so it fits in very well with the Lamrim and the scope of the initial capacity being. So we're going to be talking about death. And we've lived this far to get here to hear it, which is good. But we have to understand why we talk about death. As I explained last week, it isn't so that we can get this panicky, neurotic fear of death that most people in the world have. The Buddha didn't need to teach us how to have ordinary fear of death. Yeah, we know how to do that by ourselves. He didn't need to teach that. Okay, it's that fear of death that we're trying to counteract. And we do this by generating what's called a wisdom fear. And I put the fear in quotation marks because it's not the same panicky, freaked out kind of ordinary fear. It's a sense of the danger of dying without having practiced the Dharma. Okay, that's the point of the Buddha teaching about impermanence and death, is that we realize that if we don't practice the Dharma and we die, it's not going to be a good scene. Okay, and so the Buddha taught impermanence as a way to inspire us to practice and to get us off our tushes, or maybe I should say onto our tushes, put the tush in the cush, you know, and do some practice. Okay, so that's why we're thinking about impermanence and death, because when we don't think about death, we feel like, well, you know, life is just kind of going along, and it just goes along, and everything's fine, kind of, you know, and we get involved in all of our petty day-to-day worries and desires and all this kind of stuff. But we're totally spaced out regarding the big picture, you know. And the big picture is that we've been getting born and reborn again and again since beginningless time under the influence of ignorance and afflictions and karma. And this lifetime is one teeny, insy-bitsy thing that, you know, finally, through what we've done in the past, we have the opportunity to meet the Dharma and have the opportunity to learn the path to liberate us so that we don't have to be born again and again and again and again. Okay? And so this life is so incredibly precious. And when we realize it doesn't last long, and yet it can be used to bring so much goodness, not only for ourselves and others, then we really want to jump into our Dharma studies and practice. Yeah. When we don't think about death, it's more like, well, Dharma's kind of nice. I mean, Monday night I go bowling, and Tuesday night I grow my bonsai trees, and Wednesday I stay home and watch some television program I like, and Thursday I go, you know, to Dharma class, and Friday I go out to the movies, and Saturday I go dancing, and Sunday, you know, I go to family dinner, and so Dharma's just this, you know, kind of thing we do to feel good, you know, for a while, temporarily, yeah. But that kind of attitude isn't going to get us to really look at what's going on in our mind and start to change it. Yeah, that attitude isn't going to get us to challenge all of our afflictions. But when we really think about the fact that we're going to die, and that means that, you know, the whole world is actually going to go on without us. You know, can you imagine that? You know, how could the world do that? It can actually survive without us. And the thing is that when we die, nobody else is going to come with us. There's not going to be any big ceremony. It's not going to be like how you greeted me here, holding all in lines with holding katas, and, you know, you just kind of walk along. You know, you die, and it's like finished. You know, your friends and relatives stay here. They all quarrel about who gets what. Yeah, you work so hard to get all your money and your possessions, and then everybody quarrels about it. It's true, isn't it? Yeah? And then, so your friends and relatives don't come with you. Your body, which, you know, we've spent our whole life taking care of, it becomes the lunch for the worms. Yeah. Or you burn it and you toss it in. What river do you have around here? Some river, you know, the ocean. Yeah. So, you know, the body just kind of gets recycled in nature. Yeah, all of our certificates, our trophies, our statues, our awards, nobody else cares about them. They're all going to get thrown out. Yeah, all our possessions are going to get divided up. Yeah. And in a few years, nobody is even going to know our name. And if they know our name, you know, they'll have fabricated some story about us that isn't even true. Yeah. So, you know, but meanwhile, our consciousness has gone on into the intermediate stage, into the next life. Yeah. And it's not like everybody speaks English there and we're going to understand what's going on. You know, we're going to have no reference points because our friends, our body, our
everything that we use to create this identity that thinks we are this concrete person, all of that's gone when we die. Yeah, and all that comes with us is our karma and our mental habits. But if we've spent our whole lifetime just running after sense pleasure and being completely involved in our modus operandi, which is I want what I want when I want it, then all we're going to take with us is the karmic imprints of acting out I want what I want when I want it. And those karmic imprints are going to be what conditions our future life, where we're reborn, what happens to us, and so on. You know, so this is actually quite serious. It's quite a serious situation. And I'll start teaching this, and it's very nice the way. I don't want to give you all the points right now, but Aryadev is very good because he brings up all of our ifs, ands, and buts, because we have a whole lot of resistance to thinking about death. Yeah. And he brings it all up and then... Yeah? Okay, so I'll read the verse and then I'll kind of explain it. So the first verse in the 400 stanzas. If those whose Lord is death himself, ruler of the three worlds, without a master, sleep soundly like true vanquishers, what could be more improper? Okay, so they talk about the Lord of death in an anthropomorphic way. There's not a real Lord of death, yeah, but it just means death. Death itself. So death is a ruler of the three worlds. Three worlds means the three realms, desire realm, form realm, formless realm. So death comes to all beings in cyclic existence. Yeah, death rules samsara. And death itself has no master. It doesn't have to answer to anybody. Yeah, death just happens. Okay, and so if we, who are subject to death, act like we're the great Arya Bodhisattvas and Arhats and Buddhas who are, impermeable, who don't have to answer to death, who have gone on to the deathless stage, if, we who are under the influence of death act like we have high realizations, what could be more stupid than that? And yet that's very much how we act, isn't it? We don't really, we didn't wake up this morning thinking, well, I might die today. We woke up thinking, I'm going to live. I'm here. I'm solid. I'm me. And yet everybody else who died today woke up thinking, today I'm not going to die. I'm solid. I'm me. Yeah. So that feeling like I'm not going to die has nothing to do with reality. Yeah. Even people who have a terminal disease, who are very, very ill, every day they wake up, they don't think today is going to be the day. Yeah. I mean, this is really how much we're in denial about it. Hmm? And the thing is that knowing that we're going to die forces us to ask ourselves the question of what is the meaning and purpose of my life? And that's an incredibly important question. And how many people talk about that? Yeah, when we were in school, did anybody talk about the meaning and purpose of our life? Yeah, we're all conditioned. Oh, the meaning of your life, the purpose of your life? Make money. Have societal prestige. Have a family. But we never question that. We never ask that, Well, why? Why should I do all those things? And when when I die, what do all those things mean? And do I take any of them with me? And these are incredibly important questions. And so the fact that we are mortal puts those questions in front of us, you know. And it's very important to spend time thinking about them. Otherwise, we just go through our whole life, la, 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 la. And then, boing, death is in front of us. And at that time, we actually freak out with the emotional panicky fear of death, because we haven't made any preparation for it whatsoever. Whereas if we have a sense of the wisdom concerning death, you know, the wisdom that sees the danger of just living on automatic and dying on automatic, then we make preparation for death. And then when death actually comes, no, it's not so bad. But when we ignore death and pretend like this verse says here, like, you know, we're immune to death, then when it actually happens, it's, you know, it's pretty shocking. Second verse says, those who are born only to die, and those whose nature is to be driven towards death, appear to be in the act of dying and not in the act of living. So we feel like we're in the act of living, don't we? You know, I'm living. And dying is something that comes later. Yeah, right? Later? Dying is what happens to other people. Dying isn't what happens to me. Or if it happens to me, it happens later, 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 because I'm living. Okay, but here he's saying those who are born only to die. Yeah, what that means is that death is caused by birth. The fact that we're born is the reason we die. Once we are born, at the moment after we are conceived in our mother's womb, aging starts. And aging leads only to death. Now, we have this whole culture of youth. It's like, oh, I'm young. Aging, you know, aging is my parents' generation. Yeah. But I'm young, and we feel like I'm getting younger. We aren't getting younger, are we? We're getting older. So we're those who are born only to die. I mean, that's us. From the time we're born, we are heading to death. And our nature is driven towards death because aging is just what happens, starts happening the moment after birth. Okay, so we're actually in the process of dying. Yeah? So it's not like living wards off death. But from the moment of birth, we're in the process of dying. It's true, isn't it? Yeah? The moment something is created, it is in the process of decaying. It's not like something arises and then it's solid and concrete. And then something else comes along and makes it end. From the very moment something arises, it is in the process of changing and going towards its eventual disintegration. Well, it's in the process of disintegration and going into the process, in the case of life, to death. You know, or in the case of, you know, they made a cup. From the moment the cup exists, it's in the process of going towards being broken. Okay? So no matter what we're doing, our lifespan is decreasing. Our lifespan is not increasing. It's always in the process of decreasing. And verse 3 says, you see the past as brief, yet see the future differently. To think both equal or unequal is clearly like a cry of fear. So somebody here is saying, somebody in the audience says, well, people live up to 100, and though some time has passed, there's many more years to enjoy ourselves before we have to try and ward off death. And even when that time comes where we have to ward off death, science will have cured it by then. Yeah, science will have found a way to prevent death. Well, first of all, science is not going to find a way to prevent death. Yeah, because the very nature of things is to change each moment. Yeah, there's no way. Would you want to live in this body and have it be 1,000 years old? Okay, you know how much your aches and pains are now? How much is your body going to ache and pain at 1,000 years old? Or, you know, I mean, yeah, it's not going to happen that science is going to counteract death. And, you know, would we even want that? I know, I mean, people find so many ways to try and pretend that they aren't going to die. There's this whole field of cryogenics, you know, where they freeze the body and then hope in the meantime that science will figure out the way to overcome death and then be able to bring your body back to life. I heard Walt Disney, that's what they did with him. But many years ago, there was some place out in California that was doing this. And it's very expensive to have your body, you know, frozen until they figure out a way to bring it back to life. So there was somebody who they could only afford to have their head kept, you know, and then the cryogenics place lost the head. I mean, it's ludicrous, isn't it? But I mean, this is the extent to which we grow to deny the fact that we're dying and that, you know, finished. It's over. Okay, so here we might see the past as brief. You know, have you ever noticed that the definition of old changes as you get older? I mean, I remember when 40 was old. I remember, you know, like when I was just starting, I was a teacher before I became a nun, when I was just starting teaching, and I met somebody who was 40 years old, and I thought, she was the secretary of a friend of mine, and I thought, wow, 40, she's really old. Okay, 40 is really young now. Let me tell you, 40 is young. So every year the definition of old changes. So we always, you know, this person saying we have many years to enjoy before death is coming, and you know, and then we'll worry about it then later on. And so Aryadeva says, actually no, our future lifespan is uncertain. We're not sure how long we're going to live. Okay, and we aren't sure if our past is shorter and our future is going to be longer. You know, there's some point in middle age where you kind of acknowledge that for sure your life is more than halfway over. Yeah, you keep kind of pushing it. Yeah. Well, 40, well, no, my life's not halfway over at 40. You know, that'll wait till I become 50. Well, 50, that means 100. Well, yeah, people live to 100, you know. They live beyond that. So, you know, my life isn't halfway over yet. Then you get to 60. 60 makes it harder. But still in the back of your mind, you know, I'm going to be the person who is in, you know, Guinness Book of Records for living so long. With a perfectly clear mind and no dementia. and a very healthy body until at least 130, because my life isn't halfway over yet. Right. Okay. So, you know, if we really think that the past, our past is short and our future is long, no, because we don't really know when we're going to die. Yeah. It's very interesting, you know, walk in a cemetery sometime and look at, you know, the stones and see how long the people lived. And you start finding people who died younger than you. Or you start reading the obituaries in the paper and, oh, these people are younger than me and they're dying. The obituaries, you know, of the famous people, usually they die when they're old because it took them a long time to do things to become famous. Yeah. But still, now many of those are younger than us when they're dying. So, you know, we really don't know how long we're going to live. And do you have know of kids that you went to school with who are now dead? Yeah? If you kept up in any way with, you know, our grammar school or high school, you know, fellow classmates, and how many of them have died? And I remember even my first meditation course, you know, people from my first meditation course, many of them have died since then. Actually, one of the women I met at my first meditation course, she was my age, around my age. I was 24 when I went to my first course. And she died within a few months of my meeting her. And then you just keep track over the years how many people you know who have died. So the time of death is very uncertain. And we always feel, well, I'm healthy, so I won't die soon, you know, because I'll have to get unhealthy, and then it takes a while after you're unhealthy to die. And I remember when we started the Abbey, one of our neighbors came to help us, and he was in his early 70s, very fit. He was like doing triathlons and things like that. His doctor even said to him that he wished that he were as fit as, you know, our friend. And so he was, you know, 70, in very good health, expected to live for a long time. And then he got cancer, and he died the year before. Yeah? So just, a few years after being so incredibly healthy, then he was dead. Yeah, so we don't really know. We don't really know. Nagarjuna has a quote from Precious Garland that talks about this. He says, the causes of death are many. Those of staying alive are few. And those, too, can become the causes of death. Therefore, always perform the Dharma practices. So the causes of death are many. You know, if we think about it, there's so many ways to die. So many, many ways. You know, my superstitious mind thinks, if I think of a way that people die, then I won't die that way. Death will come as a surprise. So I have to think of all the different ways people die, and then maybe I won't die. Yeah, that doesn't work. Because, the causes of death are many. So many things cause us to die. And the causes of staying alive are actually few and very difficult to come by. Now, if you think about it, we have to spend so much energy keeping this body alive. Yeah, we have to feed it, we have to clean it, we have to exercise it. Yeah, we have to keep it not too warm, not too cold. Yeah, this body is very persnickety, and, you know, always having aches and pains. We have to do so much to keep it alive. Whereas, if we were really lazy and did nothing, the body would die. If we just sat there and did nothing, we didn't feed it, we didn't do anything, it would die. Yeah, we have to exert a tremendous amount of energy to stay alive. And yet, what this quote is saying is even some of the things that we do to stay alive become the cause of our death. Yeah, we eat food, and sometimes we eat the wrong food, and it kills us. I have a friend in Singapore whose father ate lobster, and he died from it. Yeah. Didn't plan on dying that day. He thought he was going to have a good meal, you know. But something was foul in the lobster, and he died. Yeah, and, you know, the houses we build to sustain our lives collapse. I mean, look what happened in Bangladesh. The building that they built, you know, to have a job, to keep your body alive, that building was what killed them. Yeah. So any of the things that we have to keep our life alive, to make us more comfortable, so easily becomes a cause of death. Cars, trains, you know, so many different things. Okay? And so seeing that, then it's very important to practice the Dharma and to not wait. The whole idea of, you know, well, tomorrow I'll do it. But we say, mañana en la mañana. No, because we don't know if tomorrow is going to come. Verse 4 says, since death is common to others too, you have no fear of it. Does jealousy cause suffering when only one is harmed? So here, our mind is saying, you know, although we can't be certain that our future will be longer, death happens to everybody, so there's no need to fear it. Yeah. Yeah, some people think, well, it happens to everybody, so why fear it? So the idea here about jealousy is that usually when one person only has something, then we get jealous of them. But when everybody has something, then we don't get jealous. Yeah? But what it's saying here is that if we see somebody else die, does our jealousy cause us suffering? You know, certainly not. And just because death is common to everybody, does that mean that there's no reason to be concerned about our dying? Yeah, just because it happens to everybody, so what? You know, when we die alone. It doesn't matter if the room is full of people. Yeah, when we die, our consciousness goes on alone. Okay. Verse 5 says, sickness can be cured and aging treated. Therefore, you do not need to fear them. That's what we think, right? Yeah? Sickness can be cured. Yeah? I mean, they have antibiotics now. They're coming up with this cure for this and this cure for that. Of course, not all the medicine works all the time, and the medicine produces horrific side effects, and sometimes the medicine itself kills you. But we still think sickness can be cured, and aging can be treated, you know, just get a facelift, get some Botox, and dye your hair, and go to the gym, and, you know, and we'll be young again. Yeah. So we think sickness can be cured and aging can be treated, therefore we don't need to fear them. But there's no cure for the last ordeal, which is death. Thus, obviously, we fear it. Okay. So here what Arya Deva is saying is, it's completely unreasonable not to be concerned about death simply because sickness and aging, you know, can be slowed down, and death can't be stopped. No, no matter what you do, you can't say, "Excuse me, Lord of Death, I have a very full schedule today. You know, I don't have time to die today. Please let me finish these activities. They're very important. You know, let me schedule death, you know, for sometime in the future, and by then I'll have completed everything I want to complete, and then I'll die." Doesn't happen like that, does it? Death comes, we have no choice. Zero choice. You can't appeal to anybody. You can't arrest anybody. You can't, you know, it doesn't matter who you are. Yeah. When death is there, it's there. And you gotta go. And it doesn't matter if you're rich or you're poor. Yeah. The money can't buy your wealth. I mean, the money can't buy your life. Yeah. Rich people die too. And when, you know, whether you're rich or whether you're poor, death comes, and it doesn't really matter whether you die in, you know, the first class hospital or on the streets. It doesn't really matter, does it? Because when you're dead, it's all over. And your mind stream is going on into the next life. And it doesn't matter how you died here. Okay. Then verse 6 says, like cattle intended for slaughter, death is common to all. Moreover, when you see others die, why do you not fear the Lord of Death? So here somebody says, but, though death will come, and we common beings can't avoid it, we don't need to fear it because we have no certain knowledge about it. Okay. And Aryadeva responds, actually, death is common to all. We've seen many others who have died. We know many people who are actively dying. Okay. So, and we know everybody is going to die. Excuse me, everybody's going to die. So it's silly to think that we aren't. And it's silly to think that we don't need to be concerned about our death. Okay. And it's ridiculous to think, well, I won't die because I haven't seen death, or because death happens to everybody, or whatever. So he's basically saying to us, don't be like the cows in the slaughterhouse, who see the cows right in front of them going to get butchered, and they just keep following them and walking along. And I find that quite a powerful image. You know, if you think of the cows, you know, and they're all in a line, and they can look ahead, and the ones further up are getting their necks sliced and their heads cut off, or, you know, however it is they kill them. And yet you're here watching your fellow cows over there get killed, and yet you just keep walking. You know, that one's dead, they take that one away, everybody moves up a slot, is closer to death. And the cows see that and they don't do anything. Yeah, they don't know to do anything. Or even if they have a sense of death, I'm sure they must have some sense, because the fear must really permeate, the energy of fear must really permeate a slaughterhouse. Yeah, and yet what can they do? And so here we are, and we see people dying all the time. Yeah, and yet we feel that it's not going to happen to us. Or if it does happen, it's not going to be for a long time. Or we're going to be able to plan it. Yeah. We're going to have, you know, just to have people have wedding planners, we're going to have a death planner. Yeah. We have our image in our mind of the perfect death, you know. There you are, lying on your bed. And all those nasty, horrible people who offended you and ridiculed you and betrayed your trust are now coming into the room one by one, crying, begging your forgiveness before you die. And all the people that you loved but who never loved you quite enough, they're now all coming into the room and holding your hand and saying, I love you. You're so precious to me. Don't die. Yeah. And everybody's concerned, you know. Everybody who had no time for you when you were alive, they're all around you now, you know. And they're all, you know, saying, I love you. I mean, we have this image of this perfect death where finally everybody gets it, you know, how awful they treated us and how they really should repent and tell us how much they love us. Yeah. And what chance is there that that death is going to happen? That our nicely choreographed death is going to happen as we've choreographed it. Yeah. And we're just lying there so peaceful, unafraid. And when we die, we're just have the smile on our face, gently slip out so that everybody afterwards goes, oh, she was such a good Dharma practitioner. She must be highly realized. Look how she died so peacefully. And then this image of ourself floating up somewhere going, oh yes, I am very accomplished spiritually. Yeah. Finally, I'm going to have some fame. They're all going to talk about how what a good practitioner I was because I died so nicely. Yeah. Do we really think we're going to die this way? You know, how do most people die? Yeah. Most people don't die that way. Mm-mm. And even on the outside, if it looks like they're peaceful, we don't know what's going on the inside, do we? Because their whole body, the body is not functioning. Yeah. So the body language isn't functioning. We don't know what's really going on in their mind. Okay. So verse 7, if because the time is uncertain, you think you are eternal, one day the Lord of Death will do you injury. So again, the person is saying, oh, there's no need to be concerned about death or to try and avert it because we don't know when it's going to happen. Okay? And so it's really rather foolish to think that we're eternal just because the time of our death is uncertain. Just because we don't know when we're going to die, you know, to think we're going to live forever is really rather silly. Yeah, and to the contrary, because the time of death is uncertain and unpredictable, we should be prepared from today. Okay, so and so really to give up all hope of staying alive forever and instead really put our energy into practicing the Dharma. Hmm. So if you ask yourself, you know, ask yourself, am I ready to die? Yeah. If all of a sudden, you know, today, tonight, this evening, you're going to die. Are you ready? Do you know what to do to guide your own mind at the time of death? Do you know what to think about when you're dying? Do you know what to do if frightening visions come into your mind when you're dying? Do you know how to steer your mind towards a good rebirth? Do you know how to overcome any clinging to this life and fear of death? Have we practiced the Dharma so that we know all these things? Should death come this evening? Or if death comes, are we just going to throw up our hands and say, help me, somebody, I have no clue what in the world to do. Yeah? And so if we're in that situation of, like, throwing up our hands and we don't know what to do, then that is indicating that we really need to practice the Dharma. Yeah? And to make preparations for death, and to not start later, but to start now. Because we don't know when our death is going to come. Okay? And so practicing the Dharma means transforming our mind. It means being aware of what kind of thoughts and feelings we have in our mind. And if there's something non-virtuous going on, then to know how to counteract it, how to release the non-virtuous thoughts and feelings and steer the mind in a more virtuous way. And so some people think, well, I've been practicing Dharma for a long time. I know that when attachment comes, you remember impermanence. When anger comes, you meditate on patience and loving kindness. You know, when arrogance comes, then you meditate on, dependent arising and the kindness of others. And when jealousy comes, you meditate on rejoicing. And when ignorance arises, you meditate on emptiness. And I'll remember to do all of that when I die. Do we remember to do it when we're alive? When afflictions enter our mind, are we even aware that there's an affliction in our mind? Or when there's affliction in our mind, are we completely certain that we're being tormented by other people who are falsely accusing us of doing things we didn't do or, you know, something like that? When we have afflictions in our mind, do we even know it? Yeah, when attachment and clinging and greed is there, do we know it? Or do we just think, oh, I have a good motivation for going to work now. I'm, going to get a good fat paycheck. When we're angry, do we even realize anger's in our mind? Or are we just certain that, here are all these rude people. Look what they're saying to me. My goodness. Don't they know I'm not like that? Why are they accusing me? Yeah, when we're arrogant, do we recognize that we're arrogant? Or are we just like there in our smugness and haughtiness and complacency? When there's jealousy, do we acknowledge there's jealousy? Or again, are we just certain that, the world is unfair? And why do those people have those good things and I don't? And we complain about the world. So, if we think that, we're going to know how to guide our mind just because we know the antidotes for the afflictions intellectually, and we think we'll be able to guide our mind at the time of death to overcome afflictions, then we should ask ourselves, well, how well do I do that when I'm alive? Yeah, and if we can't pull our mind out of an afflicted state of mind when we're alive, how in the world are we going to do it when we're dying? And everything is so confusing because our body is, losing the ability to act as a support for the consciousness. Yeah, it's not like death is going to be there, we're going to be completely clear-minded and know exactly what's going on. Yeah. I mean, who knows? We might be exhausted, we might have dementia, who knows what the state of our mind's going to be, and we think we're going to be able to, pop it into perfect understanding of emptiness and bodhicitta at that moment. When we can't even do that when we're alive. Yeah. There's all these people who want to learn dream yoga. You know, it's like this real fad. Yeah, let's learn dream yoga and how to meditate in our dreams. And yet people can't even meditate when we're alive. I mean, not when we're awake. You know, if we can't meditate when we're awake, how are we going to meditate when we're dreaming? Yeah. And so how are we going to do it when we're in the process of dying? So we have to really, you know, think of these things. Verse 8 says, if you consider future goals but not your waning life, who would call intelligent such selling of yourself? Okay, so here somebody is saying, though death is certain, fear of death arouses aversion only in the cowardly. The brave, to gain reward and honor, are undaunted even when weapons harm them in battle. Thus, we aren't afraid of death. Okay, so here, if you consider future goals and not your waning life, so you're looking at, you know, I'm going to have so much respect and reward and glamour because, you know, I'm so excellent at my profession and I'm going to get all these accolades and wealth because of it. And so we're thinking of our future in that way, but we're not thinking of death. Then he's saying, who would call that intelligent, considering that you're selling yourself? Yeah. So in the name of wealth and fame and so on, we're creating tremendous negative karma. Our whole life is going by, and yet we think that we're very special because, unlike the cowardly people, we aren't afraid of death. It's kind of silly, isn't it? Yeah? I mean, you hear people say that. Sometimes people say, I'm not afraid of death, but I'm afraid of dying. Or I'm not concerned about death, but I am concerned about dying. And sometimes people say, you know, I'm not even concerned about death. But then those same people, when they get sick, they rush to the doctor immediately. Yeah, there's some fear there, isn't it? That's the ordinary fear of death. That is what we're trying to overcome through our Dharma practice. Okay? And so realizing that we're going to die emphasizes to us the necessity of practicing the Dharma. Verse 9, why do you do ill deeds, pledging yourself as security? Of course, like the wise, you must be free of attachment to yourself. So he's being sarcastic here. So somebody says, if it's reprehensible to sacrifice our life for wealth, then it must be okay to perform destructive actions to safeguard our life. Yeah, kind of. So this is refuting the person before who was going to go after fame and glory and saying, well, that's reprehensible. But, you know, considering my life is so important, it's okay if I do negative actions in order to stay alive. Yeah, so I can, you know, steal if I need food or beat somebody up or kill them if they're threatening me or, you know, lie in order to, you know, keep myself alive or something like that. And Aryadeva here answers, why are you going to do destructive deeds for the sake of a little food now, pledging yourself to experience great suffering later? The idea here being that by doing negative actions now in order to stay alive, we are putting the imprints of negative karma on our mind stream, and we will have to experience the result of that negative karma in our future lives. So it's like we're pledging ourselves, we're selling ourselves or pledging ourselves as collateral that's, you know, going to get wiped away in the future when we experience the result of the action, the harmful actions that we've done in order to stay alive in this life. Okay. So we really have to think about this. Now, am I willing to create negative actions in order to stay alive in this life? How am I going to act if there's, some situation in which my life is threatened? What kind of actions will I take to prevent my death? Will I harm another living being to do that? Is my life more important than somebody else's life? If I create negative karma sustaining this life, then am I guaranteed to be able to purify it before I die? There's a lot of quite important questions here. Very important questions. And verse 10, no matter whose life, it does not differ from the moments of mind. This people certainly do not perceive. Thus it is rare to know the self. So here what he's saying is that the nature of things that arise due to causes and conditions is that they change. Moment to moment they change. They don't remain the same the second moment. So the life of any sentient being is not different than all the individual moments of mind, which are rapidly changing. And so people who, our minds, which are clouded by this misconception of permanence, grasping ourselves and others to be permanent, we don't perceive this. And we think that all these moments of mind are all alike. So instead of seeing, our body changing moment by moment, and our mind changing moment by moment, we see ourselves as some kind of permanent self, some kind of permanent something, And of course, being permanent, then we're not aging, we're not dying. Yeah, the self is not going to, the self as we know it now is not going to stop. It's not going to change. Now, but we just think this way and have such faith in that view of permanence because of how ignorant our mind is. Yeah? And sometimes the depth of the ignorance of our mind is really shocking. Really shocking when we look at it and see how even after this 1 hour of talking about death, we probably all still feel in our heart of hearts, I'm not going to die today. Yeah, I have time to meditate on death. I have time to change my mind. I have time to ease myself into the Dharma practice. I have time to keep my precepts later on or take precepts later on. So even after hearing this, still it's like it doesn't get through to us. I mean, our ignorance is so thick. It's amazing. So Aryadeva, really taught this text so that we would think about this again and again and again and again, because it's only through the repetition that we finally, start to chip away at this block of ignorance that keeps us so frozen in our wrong conceptions. So we really have to think about this repeatedly. And if I'm going to die, what is important for me to do in life? And what is not important for me to do in life? If I'm going to die, do I need to win every argument? Yeah. If I'm going to die, do I need to be comfortable all the time? And throw temper tantrums when I'm not? Now, if I'm going to die, does everybody have to apologize to me? If I'm going to die, does everybody have to recognize me and appreciate me and tell me how wonderful I am? Yeah. I mean, what is really important? What do we want to be thinking about at the time we die? And if there's some kind of thing we don't want to be thinking about at the time of death, then we should do our best not to think about that while we're alive. Yeah, so holding on to grudges? What's the sense? If you don't want to die hating somebody, why live hating them? If you don't want to die feeling guilty, why live feeling guilty? Why not do some purification practice and clear up your past? Okay? So there's a lot to think about here and to really put into practice. So we'll stop for this evening and then we'll continue. We continue on Thursday nights. And so you're all welcome to join in the stream teachings and hear what comes next. And hope that we're all alive for it. Because we don't know, do we? Okay, so let's dedicate.
Let's see. To the first pink sheet. Before we dedicate, I'd like to thank our sponsors, Karen Mastroianni and David Maclis, whose dedication is to the long, healthy lives of our wonderful teachers. And I guess we don't have time for the prayer list. So, okay. So, let's read the first one. We all, the Long Life Prayer for His Holiness, the Dalai Lama. We know. Now let's do the dedication prayers on the back of the first bay sheet at the bottom, which says, due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the supreme jewel bodhicitta that has not arisen arise and grow, and may that which has arisen not diminish but increase more and more. Just as the brave Manjushri and Samanta Bhadratu realize things as they are, also I dedicate all these merits in the best way that I may follow their perfect example. I dedicate all these roots of virtue with the dedication praises the best by the victorious ones thus gone over three times so that I might perform the noble bodhisattva deeds. In the land encircled by snow mountains, you are the source of all happiness and good. All-powerful Chenrezig Tenzin Gyatso, please remain until samsara ends. Savior of the snowland teachings and transmigratory beings, who extensively clarifies the path that unifies emptiness and compassion, to the lotus in the hand, Lord Tenzin Gyatso, I beseech, may all your holy wishes be fulfilled. The one who masters speech at a very young age, the one with great patience who received the name Avatara, the one with great precision who spread the teachings of Lama Tsongkhapa on bliss and void, Lama ornament of the yellow hat tradition, please remain until samsara ends. You uphold the subduer's moral way, who serve as the bountiful bear of all, sustaining, preserving, and spreading Manjana's victorious doctrine, who masterfully accomplished magnificent prayers honoring the three jewels, save for myself and others, your disciples. Please, please live long.